Hello and welcome to the Recovering from Religion podcast. Our mission here is to offer hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. What follows is the audio from selected videos posted on Recovering from Religion's YouTube channel. So sit back, relax, and enjoy. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Faces of RFR. I'm Eric Wells. I'm the support group director for Recovering from Religion. And in this series, we sit down with various volunteers, RFR volunteers, and kind of get to know them, get to know what makes them tick, understand why they joined RFR as a volunteer, and just have some fun. So we've interviewed several folks over the last few months, and they're all been awesome. And today is no exception to that rule. We have got a fantastic person that we're going to be talking to today. Allow me to introduce you to Naomi. Hello, Naomi. How are you doing?
Good. Thanks, Eric. How about you?
I'm doing fantastic. I kind of like doing these things. Like you and I have been interacting for several months now, yeah. But I kind of get to know you even better during these interviews. So I'm really thankful for you letting me sit down with you and kind of have this chat.
Oh, thank you for asking. And I hope I come up with some juicy pieces of gossip that maybe you hadn't stumbled over before. So
I know that's just what we thrive on is the gossip. So, what's your name and what program do you volunteer for?
Okay. So, my name is Naomi Mora. Mora is a Lebanese name. My parents are Lebanese and Naomi spells I moan backwards. So I'm pretty happy with that all together. Mora means bitter in Arabic, would you believe? And I don't feel I'm that bitter, but that's what it means.
So do you moan bitterly then?
Sometimes. We'll see. We'll just see how this goes. I volunteer in the capacity of a sort of co-lead for a support group. So I support, I do the support groups in Australia or Sydney at the moment with Sherry. So that's what I'm doing. But I'm also trying to help out a little bit on the project, sort of behind the scenes. Yeah, that's it for now. I'm thinking about the helpline, but I just got to fit it into the schedule.
You don't sound like you're necessarily from the U.S. Like you and I have different accents, and I'm here in Denver, Colorado. And so you're in Sydney. You're in the Sydney area.
Yes, I'm in Sydney, Australia. So I was born and bred here, but I spent something like 11 years living in London. So sometimes people can hear a little bit of a twang. It's possibly that. Born and bred in Sydney, Australia. So we're pretty lucky. It's winter and it's 22 degrees today. So that's pretty Celsius.
I don't know what that is in, maybe that's in the 40s or something. No, because zero is 32 for us.
32. Oh yeah, so it'd be.
So it sounds like you're in the 60s maybe, 50s.
Maybe. Yeah, maybe. I know I look pretty good for my age, but yeah.
So you've been in Australia, kind of born and raised there, you guys just recently went through some like big, huge bushfires. Like the whole country seemed to be on fire.
Absolutely, yeah, it was pretty bad. So that was over the heat of the summer, it got pretty bad. And for even places that weren't affected by the fire. The smoke was pretty bad. But as it was, I was living in London for that time. So I didn't actually, suffer but loads of people did and animals, of course, like that we all saw on the news. So yeah, it was pretty horrific. And then after that, there were floods.
Of course.
Yeah. So that wasn't helped because the fires had obviously killed off a lot of the trees. And then after that was, COVID. So it's been a big year, let's say.
How's Australia handling COVID? I've seen like it's been pretty okay. Pretty darn well. Yeah.
Very well, actually, under the circumstances. But then we are on the other side of the world and it's not that hard or, the Australian government doesn't find it that difficult to shut the borders. They quite like not letting people in. So it was a very early thing that happened in Australia where they just shut down the borders. And if you arrived from overseas, you had to quarantine for 2 weeks. I think that prevented a lot of the influx of disease. So hopefully we can just hold like that for a while until either they sort out a vaccine or something, you know.
We're having this interview in July and might be released a little bit later on down the road. But as I was kind of looking at some of the numbers, it seems like so many of the majority of the states, the Australian states, have had like no new cases for a while.
And
there's like less than maybe 10 or even less than 20 in some of the other states.
It's embarrassing, actually, when you look at the numbers in other countries. But so much of it's got to do with the low population and the big space in Australia. So we already sort of socially distance because it's not that packed. Even Sydney City, you still get quite a lot of personal space. People aren't living so much on top of each other as like London or New York or something like that. So it's sort of naturally happening. And at the same time, you know, I just kind of feel like the early shutdown is what it sort of worked. In Victoria, just recently in one of the states, there was a bit of a spike. But again, that came from people who come in from overseas and then didn't quarantine. Yeah. So I think we'll still get little things that pop up here and there, but nothing in comparison to how other countries have been suffering. So we're being very lucky in that regard.
Good for you guys. Yeah. So what do you do in Sydney? What puts some food on the table for you?
Oh, well, it's a funny one, Eric. I used to work in HR. So I say I used to because I managed to arrange finishing up my job in March. And the plan was, I was in London at that point, the plan was to go and travel Europe for 3 months and then come back to Australia and find a job. So that was the worst possible plan.
Yeah, how's that working out for you?
Yeah, it's been awesome. So basically instead of flying into Europe to some beautiful country, we flew straight home, went into quarantine, and that's where we've been ever since. And this has not been the best time to come searching around for work. So I've managed to get a contract now, so I'm doing that, but I'm moving back into training. I did come into HR through learning and development, and then I moved into being in HR, and now I'm thinking about flipping back a little bit to that training side. So it's good. I got a contract, part-time contract working for a not-for-profit in Sydney. So yeah, I'm excited for that.
Is that something you like to do, is to train folks?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. So this might be a nice link, Eric, into my religious history. But I was brought up as a Jehovah's Witness. So there was an element of being taught how to teach and how to study and how to approach people with new ideas and all of that stuff came.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Because you had to go door to door.
For sure, yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right.
And then once, if ever anyone ever did say, yes, sure, I'm interested, on the rare occasion that happened, you had to teach them about your beliefs and the Bible and the whole thing. So there's a real, there was a strong encouragement to do that. And I think maybe I have a natural inclination that way anyway. So it wasn't too big a stretch to think about teaching people things that are actually true after leaving that religion. So that's kind of what drew me into it in the first place.
Well, yeah, so let's get into that. So you came from Jehovah's Witness. What's the story? How'd you get into it?
Yeah.
What was your experience like? How'd you get out of it? Or
sure.
Are you out of it?
Yeah, gosh. all right. So how I got into it is that I came out of my mother's stomach and they were already Jehovah's Witnesses.
So you were kind of born into the religion.
Born into it, yeah. So that was normal. That's what I thought was true and that's what I thought life was about. Although they're both Lebanese, they were both Jehovah's Witnesses in Lebanon. And then they immigrated to Australia.
Were their parents Jehovah's Witnesses too?
Not my mum's, but my dad's parents were.
Okay.
Or mother was, and her parents were. So they had quite a long history on my dad's side of being a Jehovah's Witness. My mum had converted just before she got married to my dad. And so, yeah, I was brought up with it. I have three siblings who were older. I was the youngest of four. And we just, I suppose you just grow up thinking this is life, right? And this is normal. And that's what it was. So I actually didn't have a terrible experience as a Jehovah's Witness at first, because I quite enjoyed the social aspects and the community aspects of it. I was quite sociable, and it allowed me to express that quite a lot. The beliefs were sort of secondary. I think I did believe it. I mean, there were some things I always struggled with. I did always struggle to pray. And I think...
What do you mean? Like, what was tough for the act of praying? What was tough for you about that?
So I don't think Jehovah's Witnesses are that different to other religions, where they position God as a loving father, or like a, you know, as someone that you would approach in times of, you know, when you wanted something, or, you know, you were struggling. That didn't represent my view of a father. My father was not like that. I mean, he wasn't the worst that I've heard of, but I didn't see him as someone that I would approach. I was quite scared of him. And that meant that I couldn't associate this idea of a loving father to God, because I just didn't, even as a child, I just didn't see, I saw that as someone you feared. And so I sort of did fear God in that regard. And honestly, you've only got to read half the Bible, most of the Bible, to understand why you might have a fear in God as it's described in the Bible, as he's described. So I never really wanted to sort of sit down and have a chat with him about my problems. So prayer was always a bit of a struggle. I tried, and then sometimes I would just talk to myself instead of praying. I would sort of, you know, talk to yourself. I don't know what you would call that. But the main thing that happened was that quite early on in my life, I thought there was something wrong with me. I was attracted to women, and I knew it. I knew I was different. I didn't know that that's exactly what it was. I knew that I wasn't chasing the boys like others. And, you know, I just felt like, something is not right. And then, of course, as you get a little bit older and you start to get to your teens, then you're like, oh, this is actually a problem. And my answer to that at the time, with very limited exposure to anyone gay, so I didn't know anyone gay or no exposure to that world, I thought, well, I must be a man. Maybe I'm a man. I mean, I like to wear clothes that are not very feminine. I don't have very feminine interests. Maybe I'm just a man and something's gone wrong and I've not sort of come out as one. And so maybe I'm trans. So I did a lot of work and research into what that is, and thought, it doesn't sound like me totally, but maybe this is something that I'm suffering from. I was looking for an answer in the form of something medical, because I felt that people might understand that, as opposed to a choice, which is where I think they position being gay.
Yeah, especially so, in the community you were in at the time, the very religious.
Absolutely. Not only the religion, but my parents' cultural heritage, both of those things there that sort of would allow them to make that okay. So I just got to a point where I thought, well, I can't be. So this is not what's happening. So I really threw myself into the Jehovah's Witness religion, because I thought, I'll make it up. Like, God knows if this is what I am. I don't know why he made me like this and then expects me to not, you know, to just suffer with it, but okay. Yeah. Then I'll throw myself into the religion. And I did the thing in the religion called pioneering, which is, I guess, a bit like a full-time job preaching. And I did that for a couple of years. Jehovah's Witnesses don't encourage further education. So I'd left school at 16, had very little, you know, real education. So you sort of do full-time preaching and you support yourself with whatever work you can kind of get part-time. So I did that for a while.
Wow.
And I thought,
full-time preaching. So this was a huge time commitment then.
Yeah.
And you left school at 16, and you went full time into preaching, and you had to also somehow make ends meet. Because were you?
I was at home.
Okay.
Wow. So that made it a bit easier. But yeah, I mean, I managed to get some work where other Jehovah's Witnesses were working, so there was some opportunity to just pick up some work. And it paid okay, actually, for what it was, very underskilled work. So I did that for a while and thought, this will help, right? Because there's quite a lot of spinsters in the Jehovah's Witness religion, because you can't have sex before marriage, you can't marry outside the religion, and the religion has four women to one man. So
really?
Yes. So the choice was awful, Eric. I mean, you would have just been like an Adonis. You could have had your choice. And that's the point. They do very average, I think, you know, they have huge choice of women, to, you know, young women, I suppose. And they are young because there's no sex before marriage. So people get married quite young. I just thought, I'll just be single. I'll just be a single woman in this environment, and that'll be fine. And I didn't last very long. It was very embarrassing, actually. By the time I was 19, I was like, I can't do this. I can't do it. I was so sad and miserable about everything, mostly because I felt that this is a very limited life I'm going to have, especially because you could sort of start seeing people. I don't know. I'm quite a loving person. So to just have this idea that I'm just never going to have that love in my life, I thought I could do it. And then anyway, I definitely couldn't. So I felt like, oh, well, what I'll do is I'll end it because I'm done. Like, I don't want to have to live my whole life, be miserable. I'd rather just call it now. And so I wrote quite a long email to my brother. So both my brothers had left the religion at this stage, and it was just me and my sister left within the religion. So I wrote to one of my brothers that was sort of closest to me in age, and I said to him, this is it. I think I'm transsexual. I think I can't be, because that's not acceptable, and I'm just going to have to end it. I don't really know what else I can possibly do. I can't live like this. And both my brothers had just together moved to London and had got a house that they were living together at. And so my brother basically just said, guess what? You just need to book a flight and come to London and figure it all out. Like,
wow.
Yeah, it was amazing.
That was, wow. That's like an incredible opportunity, your brothers. And it almost sounded like, look, you don't have a choice in this.
You're
come and live with us.
Yeah. And just made it very easy, which would have otherwise been quite difficult. And it was only 8 weeks between, I think it was about 8 weeks between me going, okay, I'll do that, and rocking up in London as a sort of 20-year-old, basically. So,
So we're talking a little bit about suicide. Is that something that is common in the Jehovah's Witness? Do you know anything about that outside of your experience?
Yeah, it's good. I haven't got an idea of numbers, and I'm sure someone somewhere would know. But I've heard of people that I have known do that. I'm sure that, like, just indirectly through hearing other people speak about it, not only has it been thought about, but it's obviously been done by some people, because I think there's a feeling of trappedness to it. And in any situation where you feel trapped and you feel that your only options are be miserable or leave and lose everybody, and that also equals be miserable, is difficult. So it's hard to see a way out. And I guess it's an unintended consequence of their shunning rule, where they think that what they're doing is encouraging you back into the fold. That doesn't always work out the way they think it does.
It almost sounds too like, and correct me if I'm wrong,
yeah.
It almost sounds like this is the one thing that I can control. If this part about, if my sexuality isn't accepted, then I have the power to end this. And so yeah. I can, this is something I'm in control of is my own life. And so it almost may sound somewhat empowering to somebody. Yeah.
It's proactive, you know, yeah, Eric, I'm a lot of things, but I'm not, you know, I'm certainly not, not proactive. I quite like, taking action. And the thing is with that is I sort of, there are some belief systems in the religion, which is that, their belief is that, if you've died before Armageddon, there's a chance you might be resurrected back to life. So I thought, well, that's good because I'm not going to make Armageddon because God knows what I'm, what's going on. So why not, take that risk? And also sometimes you're just in so much sort of emotional pain that you just want it to sort of take a break from it. So there is that part of it.
So you went to London.
I went to London. Basically, my brother and his partner then took me to a lesbian bar, which existed, which was a thing.
Wow.
And just said, look, let's just, you know, check it out. And I just found the whole thing so intimidating and scary that I came back and I was like, yeah, I'm pretty sure I'm not. So that's good. Thank you. Like, thanks for that. But that's not what I am. And it didn't take long after that where I sort of hopped online and, you know, got into these chat rooms. And I mean, very old I am. And so this was back in the day of MSN chat and ICQ and dial up. So no one could use a phone while I was online. I mean, literally. That's how old I am, Eric. So
look, I had a collection of those AOL CDs. you know, I would take a ton of them and like hang them from my ceiling and have like this glittery ceiling with, you know, and so yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about.
It's a whole nother time. It feels like so long ago.
Yeah.
But that was really good. So that helped me build a network of people, and periodically they would arrange a meet. And that's really when I started to get more comfortable with the fact that actually it's not as massive or complicated as I had thought it was or I had made it. It's quite simple. I'm attracted to women, but I'm fine being a woman. And that meant I met someone then and it sort of took off from there. But when I met someone, I then had to, after a while, think about, oh, God, you know, my visa's going to run out and I have to go home and I just need to decide what I'm going to do. And really that was when I decided that, yeah, I'm not going to be able to be a Jehovah's Witness, so I'm going to have to leave. I'm going to have to tell my family and friends. It was about 2 years into it. And at that point, I didn't change my beliefs. So my belief was I'm going to die at Armageddon, but at least I'd have had a nice time. So whenever that comes, I've just accepted that's my fate and I don't mind, but I feel like I've been able to have a nice time.
Wow. So you still kind of held on to the belief that Armageddon was going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And then you sort of like resigned yourself to I'm going to have a good time while I'm here.
Yeah.
And I'm okay with that. Man, that's awesome.
I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
Well, because I thought I was going to kill myself anyway. This is another type of killing myself, but at least I've had a nice time in the lead up. And so it did take a few years after that to lose the beliefs and to start to really think about what I was believing. Mm-hmm. And then a few years after that to get really comfortable with who I was in terms of my identity and not feel that same shame that I think I did, even though I was doing it, and lose some of that and then just be a bit more comfortable with who I was and find sort of some happiness. And I mean, honestly, this is like years and years in some ways to get to this point. And, you know, then I had to go through the shunning of friends, you know, then you have the shunning of family, except my mum. So my mum, bless her, has always maintained contact. She's often very sad, or she was at the beginning very sad because she felt that I was going to die at Armageddon, but then so were my brothers and she felt that she'd sort of failed her job as a mother. But it was hard, you know, it was hard to rebuild your life and your network. And in some ways, it was made easier for me because I had to do that anyway by moving countries, build a new network of people. It might have been even harder if I had to stay in the same place and do it, because then I would really notice the gap. Whereas if I was on the other side of the world, I had no choice but to do that. So that did make it a bit easier. Maybe I didn't notice it so much.
And you were able to kill two birds with one stone, basically.
Exactly.
Yeah. Very nice.
Yeah, so that worked. I didn't kill any birds, just to make it clear, in case the police are looking at this, or I don't know.
we'd say kill. Do you have peeps in Australia? You know what peeps are?
Yeah, peeps.
Those marshmallow disgusting.
Oh no! What is that?
They're like these marshmallow candies that are in the shape of a baby chicken, like a chick. And they're yellow edible glitter all over them, and like these candy eyes, and you just eat them.
Eric, are they delicious, or they sound kind of gross the way you're saying it? Are they awful?
They're awful. What is fun to do though is you take a peep out, you throw it in the microwave, and just watch it like
explode.
Or you can put a whole package of peeps in there and watch them. So anyways, okay, well, I was trying to think of some
birds that you could kill.
Yeah, that you could kill and bite the head off and nobody would really care about.
I'm tracking back through your thought process and I think I got it.
So how would you kind of describe your current beliefs? Like, where are you at now?
I've been trying to define it a bit more clearly. I've sort of just drifted for a very long time, actually. But through connecting with RFR recently, I wanted to be a bit more definite about what I felt. And I think I am a secular humanist. I think that's probably the nearest to what I could find that would explain how I feel. I'm very content with that. I wish it was a more vocal and organized group, because I think there's a lot of people that feel that way, just don't know it has a name. And, you know, I don't want to be political, but I also feel that religions are so much more organized at lobbying governments and stuff like that. And it has made me think that I would like to be more involved in lobbying governments from a secular humanist perspective. So, yeah, I mean, I hate the fact that organized religion is so prescriptive, but there is something good about it, is that it's quite together and they can sort of get some stuff done. So I'd quite like to be more involved. Yeah.
I love it. Yeah, I've done some work, some activism work with the government. It's for me, it was like kind of scary at first.
Yeah.
Kind of like, I have no idea what's going on here, and all these people know one another. And but you know, after a little bit, you kind of see how it works and get more comfortable with it and get to know people. And yeah, it's rewarding. It's pretty rewarding working.
I reckon that's pretty good. And so much goes on that people just don't think it is a problem until you've come out of a religion and you're like, no, that is a problem. You know, that is a religious thing that you're putting on the people of this country, and we're not all religious. Right. And I'm sure you see that as well. And because Jehovah's Witnesses don't get involved in politics, so they don't vote. So I never knew. So when I had to vote for the first time, that was weird. Like, who do I vote for? How do I vote? Like, what is this? So all these kind of baby steps introduction to being a full citizen and being involved. So yeah, of course it's all very intimidating at first, and then
so that's one of the challenges then ex Jehovah's Witnesses, ex JWs have to work through and figure out is the whole like voting process, the whole getting involved in politics.
It's part of a bigger thing, which is about how do you reset your mind to not think the world's going to end any day now. That reset, politics is involved in that. One aspect of it, because you know, if the world's going to end, what the hell difference does it make who you vote for? What the hell difference does it make what their policies are? Because God's going to change this whole thing, and so none of it matters. And so to kind of go, oh, no, the world's not going to end. And we really need to think about our future, because we're going to be here for a really long time. hopefully. Although, who knows at the moment? Who knows?
It's just us. There's really, there's nothing else out there, really. And
no,
we've got to figure this out. There's no instruction manual.
Yeah. It's at the same time, terrifying to think you're on your own.
Right.
And exciting, because for the first time, what you do matters. It just doesn't feel like you're such a victim to whatever God decides. You just feel a little bit more able to control things a little bit. Yeah. And, I always say that the minute I accepted that I was going to die and that was going to be how I ended my life, not through an Armageddon or that, someone else got to decide, that liberated me. I'm not terrified of death. It's knowing that there's a deadline. I mean, I know it's a literal thing, was the best thing. I was able to stop putting things off, because the whole thing is about James Winston's. It's like, don't worry about it now. Don't worry about education now. You'll have the rest of paradise to get educated. Don't worry about doing the things that you want to do, travel or have a career. Don't do that now, because you can do that for the rest of eternity when you're going to be living on earth in a paradise.
Right.
So when you're deferring, the best thing to have said to me was actually, no, see this life, this is it. So you better do everything you want to do now. And what I find with other Jehovah's Witnesses and other people that have had to reset that way is there's a sense of urgency to life. And I feel that sense, like, I want to do these things. I want to get these things done. Because if I don't do it, it's not going to happen for me. And I try and use that as a good thing. But it can feel quite manic at times where you just like, yes, I want to do that. And I want to do that. And I want to do that.
Yeah. I feel exactly the same way. Yeah. This is it. We have an expiration date.
Yeah.
I need to get these things done before that expiration date comes.
For sure. And it doesn't stop me from watching shit TV, Eric. I'll still watch crap TV, and I know I'm wasting the one and only life that I have, but it's still worth it.
You enjoy it.
Yeah, exactly.
You enjoy it.
Exactly.
Speaking of shit TV, I was watching the original Batman series, like from the 60s.
That's not shit morning. TV.
It is shit. It is so shitty. Oh, it is great. It is the... This morning, I had my bowl of Captain Crunch cereal.
Oh my God!
Watching these 1960 TV shows, and it was just a waste of time. But I loved every second of it.
Like you were 8 years old again.
Exactly, like Saturday morning.
Yep. I mean, not even granola or some healthy cereal. No, like totally proper, just going
shit
for
cereal,
it.
Shit show. It was great.
I love it.
That's part of life, like enjoying the moments and having fun, because this is all we've got.
Yeah, absolutely. Or just not to feel bad about doing something for yourself or something that feels good for the sake of the fact that it feels good and there's no other purpose. There was just so much encouragement of suffering and so much, they'd really celebrate suffering in a way. If you were suffering, that was a good thing. That was sort of part of the that's how it has to be. Whereas, you couldn't be too comfortable. You couldn't be enjoying your life too much. Sleeping in on the weekend, I relished not having to go preaching. Joseph says, fill your time, your evenings with meetings, your days with preaching. And just to wake up on a Sunday and literally do nothing until 1 p.m., I enjoyed that. And, I really got very lazy for a while afterwards. And then I was a bit like, oh, no, God, I better do something with my life.
All right, now let's get going. All right, I've rested.
Yeah, done
laziness.
Now.
Let's get back to work. I love it.
Exactly. Yeah.
What was the hardest things or one of the hardest things that you've had to overcome coming out of the Jehovah's Witnesses or coming out of the religious mindset?
I think probably one of the hardest things was, they were different at different times, but one of the hardest things was when I did figure out that it wasn't right, just not trying not to then be as proselyzing as I was when I was in. So I felt really angry for a period and frustrated that I still had friends and family who believed what I thought now was not true, that I wanted to just say to everyone, like, this is rubbish. Like, you guys need to come out. And so it took a while for that to settle into something like, it would be good if people could be educated and people could see a different perspective, but it's not on me to try and convert them out. I'd spent my life learning how to convert people and how to preach and how to just like sort of be single-minded. And it's hard to leave a space of certainty and enter a space of uncertainty, which is what I think secular humanism is. So to go from like, I know exactly what everything is and I know the answer to every single question that you have, even if the answer is just have faith in God, I still had an answer. Over here I've had to move into like, I don't know. I know some things, but I don't really know. And not only to feel comfortable with that, but to feel that that's the right way of being, to feel comfortable in myself. So accepting other people may make different decisions, may have different belief systems. Maybe my mum will never leave. You know, I used to just think there's got to be a way I can get her out. She's such a loving person, such a giving person. This is like not a good place for her. But I have had to accept, not give up, but accept that actually it might be that's where she lives and dies, and that might be right for her. And I just have to accept that they are her beliefs, and that might be it. It's hard, right? Like, yeah.
Yeah.
So that's.
Yeah, that is something that I still struggle with. So
yeah,
to hear that you've gotten through that and
still going, Eric. Thanks. Work in progress. Some days you're like, geez. Yeah.
Yeah, that is true. But yeah, that's a struggle that I have as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not easy, especially for the people that you love and care about. But
yeah,
we were both, you know, we were on the other side of it, that we loved and cared about other people and we wanted them to be saved. We wanted them to join us in this eternal happiness, eternal bliss. And so I think that somewhat even points to your humanity and how much you care for other people too.
I agree. I think that's a value that can stick from being brought up in quite a religious environment. Not everyone, but I found that something that stuck. I want to help people. Yeah. So whatever that means, I mean, whether that is through, you know, work or, you know, whatever, you do have this drive to want to help people. And yes, I think we had the intention that we were thinking that was the right thing to do and that we were helping people. But now I would just want people to have good, healthy mental health. And that doesn't usually come with a very strict set of beliefs in a religion, in my opinion.
Yeah. Mm. So how did you first hear about Recovering from Religion? What was your first experience
how did you
hear about RPR?
So I heard about it through someone who was already involved, so through Sherry. And I'd sort of reached out to her. So do you remember how I said I'm not very good at not having anything to do, and I was unemployed when I came back and in quarantine. So I was looking for things to kind of get involved in, and giving back to those leaving religion has always been something that's been a little bit on my to-do list, because I thought I had lots of people helping me and I can't imagine what it was like for someone who didn't have, I had two brothers who had already left, who were able to support me, not just physically, but emotionally and, you know, sort of mentally throughout the whole thing. Whereas I think others have to do that first step on their own. And so I wanted to do something. I had been, bear with me, but I had been messing around in comedy, and probably for about 18 months, I'd been doing comedy with a Bible on stage, where I would make people read a story with me in the Bible that was true, that was in there, but was completely outrageous, that people did not know about. And so I tried to make it a bit funny, but I felt what I was trying to do at that stage was unpreach all the preaching I had done, is draw people's attention to something that was not good about it. And I had done things like I'd a show about Jehovah's Witness, or me leaving the Jehovah's Witness religion and coming out. I'd done a show at the comedy festival, and that's actually how I met Sherry and Sasha. So that was a good.
Oh, that's cool.
They came along to the show. Sorry, your question. So recovering from religion was the first time that I thought, oh, I could get involved in that. Like, that's something I could actually volunteer, and I've got the time at the moment, and I'm interested in the topic, and I feel ready in case, you know, all that worry about would people find out I was doing something like this, all that backlash, all that potential, how ready am I to listen to others and not just make it about me? I just felt in the right place to actually get involved, and that's how I've managed to kind of get involved. And so she talked about doing a support group, and I was like, yeah, do you want a hand? And that was perfect. Yeah.
Let's do this.
yeah exactly.
So you kind of touched on it, like, why did you want to do it? Just to give back a little bit, and you just had some time on your hands?
Yeah, I had some time, and I felt I was a bit older. That's not an age thing. I just felt a bit more capable of being able to hold other people's weight rather than just my own. I didn't feel earlier, I think I'd have been too impacted by it or whatever. But now, as much as I still feel empathy for people, I've had some distance from my own time of that. And so it feels at the right time to help others and be reminded, actually, which has been a good thing, how hard that was, you know?
Yeah.
You move forward always, and you forget, and then suddenly there's new things and you're onto other things, and you've forgotten how hard that mountain was that you climbed. So, yeah.
So what do you get out of volunteering?
Well, I get educated. So I probably feel more educated about the process, about the psychology, about all of the things to do with leaving a high control environment. The most educated I've been has been since I signed up to volunteer for RFR, because of all the resources that are available, not just, you know, online, which I could have probably maybe eventually found myself, but through all the RFRX talks that I listen to, through all the resources and the community that you guys build, it just adds something more. And reminds me of things I didn't even think or know that I will have experienced, and maybe some of the reason why I felt certain things, or why people experience different things, and also takes you out of your own religious experience. So it's also interesting to hear about other religions and what goes on there, and how, you know, other people get out.
Yeah, that's very true. I mean, I feel like I've grown myself too quite. Yeah. I feel almost like I've gotten my capacity for empathy has also grown just listening to the other people's stories. The world has gotten smaller. You just being able to listen to people, and it's been pretty cool.
Yeah, absolutely. And the people are so great, like, that are involved. That I feel like, oh, it's a whole new network of friends, and now I can go to Colorado and meet up with people that I feel like I know.
Absolutely, yeah.
So that was one of the things about the Jehovah's Witness religion and other religions that they do very well. No matter where in the world you go, you could tap into that local community and feel like they're old friends. Whereas this is just another way of creating that same sort of global community, and so I feel good about that. Excited.
That's an excellent point. I hadn't thought about that before.
Yeah.
I really like that. Huh. So what do you see kind of in the future with your work with RFR? What would keep you going as a volunteer?
I've been mostly doing the support groups with Sherry, and the thing that's sort of lingering in my mind is the helpline. Volunteering, because I think that would be quite a good way of getting a real understanding of the sort of issues that come through that you might then be able to support in support groups. Mm-hmm. So I think one feeds the other, but I do think there might be more you could easily meet more people and hear about more things probably on the helpline, which you could bring over into support groups. So I'm toying with that idea. I just need to not over commit myself. So right. I'll probably look at doing that when I, oh, that's the other thing is setting boundaries is hard. One of the things that have come up. So I have been learning from some of the materials about setting boundaries. Once you've left a higher control religion where you are not really allowed to set your own boundaries, where they set them for you, it's quite hard. It's quite hard, that one. So I'm trying to do that. So.
Yeah, the whole autonomy thing, like you are in control of your own body, your own thoughts and actions and stuff like that. That is something that so many folks coming out of religion really struggle with at first, because they're no longer in that set of rules, that set of dogma, and you kind of experienced that too yourself.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I made the classic error of going from a high control religion, leaving that, and going straight into a high control relationship, because there were way too many decisions for someone who had never really made any decisions for themselves, or decided on what I felt about things. It was really, like, only in retrospect do you realize, I suppose, but I just really went straight into a relationship with someone who was quite happy to take all those decisions for me. And, you know, it wasn't a terrible relationship, but it was a high control relationship where I didn't, I wasn't able to make those decisions, and it was just much easier for her to make them, and I was kind of happy with that. But that took time.
It was what you were comfortable with.
Yes.
I don't think that is uncommon at all.
And it was almost like, I remember my therapist at the time said, you've replaced the religion with the religion of your partner. I was like, yes, yes, I have done that. Yes. So anyway, that is obviously a past relationship as well. So, you can kind of work through that. The whole thing has taken me like 20 years to get through, so that's kind of strange. Yeah.
Very rarely is it just something that's quick and immediate. I mean, even like for myself too, it was years and years of one thing kind of after another, a whole process. Like unwittingly, we built our worldview up as children and being born into this religion. And
yep.
We thought that's all that it is, and that's how the world works.
Yep.
And it's all torn away from you.
It is.
You kind of have to rebuild it again, but it takes piece by piece to kind of dismantle that whole worldview, dismantle that foundation. And
every now and again, you still find something in the back of a cupboard somewhere where you're like, what the hell is that?
Exactly.
I thought that tin of beans that expired in the 90s. I'm like, why have I still got that? Oh, it's terrifying. There's still things that pop up and you're like, you've got to reset your view, or what do I think about that? And, that all takes time. But actually it's weird, through COVID. So my father wouldn't speak to me, right? Wouldn't say hello, wouldn't answer the phone and say hello, like proper did the shunning thing very well. He did that exceedingly well. And so when COVID hit, and I only live 40 minutes away from my parents, I'd been talking to my mum and she said they're a bit low on toilet paper. You know when that was a big thing?
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is a mad rush for toilet paper.
I know. There was nothing anyway. Anyway, we managed to get a hold of some, and so I said I'd drop it in. Now, bear in mind, I hadn't seen my dad really in the flesh maybe for about 8 years, 7 or 8 years. Oh. And so I usually if I see mum, it's out, So I came into the house, and my dad greeted me. And for whatever reason, this COVID thing, I don't know what's happening for him mentally. I think he might be like not fully compos mentis, but he has totally started speaking to me again. I think either he's forgotten why he stopped, or the whole thing has made him rethink what he needs to do. Maybe he's trying to save me because they do think it's the end of the world. I don't know where he's coming from. I've not asked him, and I'm not going to probably. But he just suddenly
enjoy this.
It's weird. It's so weird. Who knew toilet paper was the
toilet paper brings families together.
They bring Exactly. Like, I always thought he was full of shit, but I just never realized that what he actually needed was toilet paper to help him. So, yeah, it's been a really weird experience. And I'm not sure how long it'll last. I don't know. You know, I can't trust that it will continue, but where it's at now, that's where it's at. So that's been again, you know, this whole thing about even though something that happened years ago, it's sort of a new thing to try and think about that sort of digs up old stuff.
That's wonderful. Now I've got one last question.
Go for it.
One final question. So if you could travel back in time and talk to your past self, who would you talk to and what would you talk about?
Well, if I could talk, God, Eric, that's a tough one.
Dude, I gave this to you ahead of time.
I know, but I still didn't really fully, you know, I just wanted to let it sink in a bit. I think probably what I would want to do is talk to, this is not that deep, but talk to my teachers at school. This is really weird. And the reason is because I can't get a grasp for how I was when I was at school and whether, you know, when you can just see things through your own lens. School, I loved going to school. It was, I think, some kind of escape for me. And I just wonder whether they could have told me or could have seen what was happening from the outside, what they would have said about what they saw. Because if I could have kept going to school, I probably would have, and I probably would have got into education. And that's a big regret. So then now I'm like, what could that have been? So I'd probably want to relive that a little bit and see if I could have pressured myself through them to push that button a bit. That's a really crap answer, Eric. I hope you weren't hoping for a big clanger at the end for some great...
I kind of like that. Yeah, I do kind of like that. Yeah, I think that's kind of cool. So was it kind of hard to leave school at 16? Like you just didn't want to do it or...
No, it wasn't. Because I was a 16-year-old, you know? Like basically my family, my dad, you know, wasn't really going to support it. So then I didn't feel so strongly about it at the time, but I do remember having conversations and I remember saying to my teachers, well, I'm just going to work part-time, you know, and then I'm going to, and I remember them being probably a little bit uncomfortable pushing it, but they were like, are you sure? Like, are you absolutely sure? And of course, you know, I was brainwashed. So yeah, I was sure. But that must have been a very strange experience for them to see, I think, because I did quite well at school. So it'd be weird to sort of just drop out, which is what I did. So, yeah. Mm.
Naomi, thank you so much for sitting down with us and kind of sharing your story. We got to learn a lot about you. And I was absolutely right that you were an awesome person at the very beginning. I said,
thanks, Eric. You predicted it. Was that a prediction? Imagine if it didn't come true, you'd be like, God, I set up some expectations. You have been very easy to talk to. So thank you very much.
Yeah, this was really, really cool. I learned a lot about kind of like the behind the scenes of the Jehovah's Witness, you know, what it's like from the inside too and transitioning out. You got to see both sides, what it was like inside and then looking outside, looking from outside to inside. And that was really neat to see and learn about.
Yeah, thank you. And thanks for having me. And I really enjoyed staring at your beautiful background. It felt very calm. You know, it was a beautiful thing to look at. So
yeah, I'm just sitting out here in my deck on my lake property. It's not a green screen or anything like that. No.
You've got it sorted. It looks very good.
Do you have any last words you want to impart before we sign off?
No, just like for anyone who might be thinking of volunteering, I think for RFR, especially in the support group area, which is the one that I have most experience, I just really encourage them to get involved because they get to learn a lot, help others, and, you know, get to spend some time talking to Eric.
Yeah, what could be possibly better?
And what could, yeah.
I can't think of anything.
What a great pitch.
Yeah. Join, volunteer for RFR. You'll get to talk to me.
Yeah.
That's the new motto.
That's it. No, thank you so much, Harry.
Thank you, Naomi. Well, folks, this was, like I promised, another fantastic episode of Faces of RFR. We're going to do this again real soon. And if you have any interest, like Naomi had mentioned, in volunteering, kind of giving back to the community, take a look at our website, recoveringfromreligion.org, and you can learn more under the volunteer tab. But over there too, check out all the resources we've got. Pop in on the chat, just kind of give it a try. You can click on the chat bubble in the lower corner of the website, and you can experience what the helpline team actually does. So guys, thanks again for joining us. And until next time, we'll see you later.
Recovering from Religion is a nonprofit organization whose mission it is to provide hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. Hope, healing, and support is waiting for you on our website, recoveringfromreligion.org. There you can speak or chat with a trained agent who will work with you through your struggles and doubts or to help find resources that may work for you. You can also find local Recovering from Religion support groups in your area for the long-term recovery work. Resources specifically curated for those struggling with doubts, disbelief, and trauma can also be found on the RFR website. To connect with a secular therapist in your area, go to seculartherapy.org and create an account. If you'd like to support the work that RFR does, you can donate or sign up as a volunteer on the Recovering from Religion website. It's also a big help subscribing to the RFR YouTube channel, our blog, or following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Questions, comments, and suggestions can be emailed to us at rfrx@recoveringfromreligion.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we hope you'll be with us next time on the Recovering from Religion podcast.